Welcome to the Why Isn't It Working? Business and Tech Podcast, talking all things business and tech in the emerging and enterprise space. Here are your hosts, Carl Wood and Michael Hamilton.
Hello and welcome to the podcast. With me as always is our venerable partner, Michael Hamilton. How are you today, Michael?
I'm very good, Carl. Thank you.
Excellent. And we're very proud today to have Nick Crawley. Now, Nick is a principal consultant at Vector Financial Modeling. He's been a financial modeler for the past 20 years, has a huge amount of experience in this sector, and I think is going to be great to have on for conversation around modeling, cryptocurrency, and a lot of the things we're seeing in the financial markets today. So, Nick, thank you very much for your time today.
Pleasure to be on. Thanks, guys.
Wonderful. Well, let's kick it off and get started, Nick. So how did you jump into the world of financial modeling and how did it lead you to where you are today?
Cool. Right. Okay. Well, let's go back to the beginning. And it's a little bit of a story, but I'll try and keep it pretty concise. My name's Nick. I'm 46, British and also Australian. I live in Sydney and also a little bit outside of Sydney as well. I'm a theoretical astrophysicist by training, but I spent fair bit longer these days as a risk and analysis professional, as you said, in financial modeling, which we'll go on to what that means in real life in a bit. I spent the last, look, I think it's more than 20, but it's a bit less than 25 years. So my whole career analyzing investments in large scale projects, gold mines, power plants and toll roads. And, you know, pretty much anything that can be ring fenced lends themselves well to being able to borrow large amounts of money so that the stakeholders can get better returns. Pretty much anything that's large infrastructure or comes out of the ground or generates electricity, banks some way, one way or the other have lent a large amount of that, maybe like 65, 80% of the funds. So a lot of analysis goes in behind that. So I perform my main job, as I call it, as a consultant in a global firm, one way or the other, for borrowers. I've been an investment banker, as a lender. I've been a business owner in the same field and nowadays consulting in my own right. So look, I've covered all facets of this fairly niche industry, which is, it's not like big data. It's kind of what happens after big data has been processed and there's a project kind of ready to go. So, I think it's worth touching on. You know, I think when I introduce myself often, like my heart's in science and maths, but I've transitioned into finance many years ago. It's probably worth just touching on a little bit of that because the field of finance, I mean, it is very analytical. There's a lot of problem solving of things that either haven't been done before, haven't been done well before, or need to be done very quickly. So my background, spent 4 or 5 years in astrophysics, partway through a PhD in the same subject. And, you know, maybe we can cover the transition, but the city was calling. And we can talk about the different steps after that. But it's essentially stepped into the city where the brain drain was happening. People were leaving academia to basically get paid a lot better for solving pretty much simpler problems, to be honest. And then you're in the groove. You've got a career in finance. So there's a transition from, I started off in London, as you can probably hear, and I've spent most of my career in Sydney and Australia, but working fairly globally with a couple of pretty interesting breaks, which maybe I can cover later. So that's the broad background of where I'm in terms of financial modeling as a job.
So financial modeling, and I guess we can kind of start on this point, Nick, and I'd like to come back to your past after that. You know, when we talk about these large projects, for example, you might have a large mining project that needs to build a lot of infrastructure or survey certain areas. I mean, we're really talking about a huge amount of variables that need to be, you know, calculated and assessed, aren't we? So do you think that's part of the niche job that you do that some others don't take quite to the nth degree like you have with Vector?
Look, I think it'd be unfair to say that, but what you've covered is a very good point. I'm generally at the end of a process where there's been, you know, for example, a large amount of study by mining companies, by geologists, by energy consultants, marketing consultants, all sorts of people have kind of got to the point where CEO and a board have said, we are ready to do this project. It is going to cost us $800 million. You generally don't just turn around to your shareholders and ask for that. You know, you go and raise a decent percent in the capital markets one way or the other. So the actual data involved, it's not so much when I think about the variables, you know, if I take a typical project, maybe it's a solar power plant. You might think about where is this? Somebody has already taken into account where it's located. What's the weather like on average? But someone turns to me and says, what are our returns on this project? So imagine that. You think, well, okay, I need revenue. At its most fundamental, I need revenue and costs. Okay. So sitting pretty much in a vacuum because you're not embedded in the client's project team for months on end. You're brought in for a few weeks to crunch these numbers. You kind of have to, and everybody knows about the project and they kind of assume you do. So you kind of have to, you know, spin up the way you think. Think, right, if I was developing this project, what would I need to understand? Okay, how many hours are there? How many hours of sun are there in a day on a given week? You know, is it summer? Is it winter? All these things. Do the panels move? Let's say it's a solar energy project. You know, it could be one of 20 different types of projects, say. But that's a good example. And, you know, how much are you going to get paid by the grid, which is going to change through the day, potentially, through the year, certainly, off peak and on, like, summer and winter different tariffs. And that's just to get revenue. That's just to get the first line where it says how much energy are you going to sell. So then you've got all the costs involved as well, from the breaking of the ground and the infrastructure, and you know. So you know we can keep on going all the way through tax, you know. And that's the bit that keeps the job very, very, very interesting, because at any one time I might be working on something like that, and then say a data center, a machine learning data center, where it's got nothing to do with sun. It's everything to do with, you know, loads and, you know, even what algorithms different specific miners are running. So, I've been doing that my whole career, from power stations, mines, toll roads. They're pretty boring. But, you know, I know as I drive through Sydney and go through the Cross City Tunnel or Lane Cove Tunnel, I remember those late nights and 4 a.m. finishes where I'm walking back to my apartment thinking, Monday I'll be able to use this road. And, you know, here we are sitting in a traffic jam. So, yeah, it's good. Look, there's a lot. It's not data modeling in the way we might. That's a really, from my point of view, that's quite a recent, but I mean, it's very, very valid and interesting area. But in terms of crunching data, that's not my background. But thinking about what variables you need so that the CFO can go, oh, right, okay, this is actually very sensitive to this assumption. That's exactly what my job is. Yeah. So it's quite rewarding.
Would it be, I guess, also then sort of thinking about it as a data integration, so to speak, as well? Because, I mean, ultimately, you kind of have to be the conduit for a lot of different data sources, don't you, that are often reliant on one area. But when we look at projects, you'll often have specialists in their own area that might not have a particular vision of, you know, say column X over here, because it's not what they're thinking about. So someone like yourself would have to come along and go, okay, well, as we can see, the guys in team Y do have an impact on team X, and we need to factor that in when we're thinking about, you know, projections as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's, you know, it's never more true than when you're modeling something that's got people involved. So, you know, modeling cohorts of people in a major restructuring or something where, you know, you're almost going down to the individual FTE as to their history. And, you know, you've got different competing forces. You've got the board wanting to do one thing, head of human resources and CEO and CFO wanting to do one thing financially. Then you've got regulators, you know, certainly in the cases I've been working on the last few years, where, you know, there's unions which say, no, you can only do these things. So I'm trying to get that optimum output, thinking about the same problem. It's still the same problem and the same variables, but such different perspectives from different stakeholders. That's, you know, intellectually, it's a decent challenge as well. So you might be in a meeting in the morning thinking about it from one point of view, and then you're with the accountants later on, and it's completely different, as you might imagine. So, yeah, you're right there. But, yeah, it's not sets of data, but you do end up doing a fair bit of handling because you have something like public street lighting where, you know, whoever owns public street lighting, they own every single asset of every single street light. And you think how many of those there are in New South Wales. Each one's made up of four or five different components. And you think, okay, I'm using Excel, which is the industry standard for this kind of analysis, to represent something with like 17 dimensions. At best, I've got five available to me. How do we solve this problem where, you know, if you spun up some object-oriented code, it's no problem, but the framework doesn't exist in large corporates to accept that kind of, you know, analysis. So you have to think, how do I make Excel, which, you know, sounds like it's dumbing it down, but it is the, you know, it's the industry standards with no standards, I always say. You're making your life hard just by using it, but there's not much choice. So we try and make it a little bit smarter and accommodate, you know, those sorts of, without wanting to make it sound fancy, like higher dimensions, just with better with coding and all sorts of things, such that someone can press a button and run the data. And they can still crunch data, but, you know, it's not like anyone's running hardcore algorithms to predict, you know, a fast moving consumer good take up or something.
So you also, you mentioned Excel there. A lot of the perception out there today is that you have to have some R model or Python or some sort of really high spec model that runs on cloud services to crunch data. Now, can you walk us through, for example, in your industry or different industries you've worked in, where it's all been Excel and you process large data sets? Well, how big has the data been with Excel?
So, I mean, we're not even talking access, right? This is still Excel. Sometimes you think, you know, you make the recommendation up front, this needs to be a web app, you know, done in the appropriate IDE. But you're dealing with senior people who are also paying the bills and appointing you who wouldn't know what I've just said. So you think, okay, can we get away with access, which is a pretty clunky, horrible, you know, no one wants to use it anyway. So then maybe there's an SQL database, or now we're starting to get something a little bit smarter. No, and in fact, the other day, just to help answer this exact question, just going back to late last week, we had a client come in and say, "Oh, you wrote this great kind of application. It was in Excel, but it did some pretty smart calcs to evaluate to value something, whatever it was." Piece of public infrastructure. And they said, what we'd like to do is not run it over the 10 assets that you've built it for. We'd like to run it over 25,000. Okay. And can we do that by kind of end of the week? So it's like, okay, like there is a massive disconnect. If you're in a development environment, you know, which we're fairly familiar with too, you can be as agile as you like, but there's going to have to be some serious thinking done to make that work in a way that doesn't take 3 weeks to calculate.
And when you're looking at financial markets, I know you've got obviously investment banker background here in Australia, in Sydney. Yeah. When you're applying financial modeling, for example, obviously using Excel again, as you mentioned, that's a standard in financials, markets, and so forth, would you be crunching predictive models or just profiling different types of other kind of setups?
Right, good question. Like ultimately predictive models, but not probably in the way you intended to ask the question. So a very typical framework will be, what's the return to the stakeholders of this project over the next 20 years? So you have to sit there. I mean, you and I, we're all sitting here going, okay, so once we get past next year, everything's going to be plus or minus 20%. The next year, those plus or minus 20s become plus or minus 50s. So you've got this massive like cone of uncertainty expanding in front of you. So the job is to, lots of things are contracted. So that really locks things down. So, you know, in us answering whether or not they're predictive models, like that's kind of their only job is to predict the value of the project to the stakeholder and the maximum financial distress placed upon the project's cash flows by the obligation of borrowing money. So no different to a bank evaluating you for a mortgage, but it's a lot more complicated because they'll need to bank, you know, they'll be looking to be able to flex global gold prices. Let's say it's a gold mine, hedging strategies, operational costs, blowouts. You know, what happens if this project has to pause for a year? We've worked on a few mines where underground mines where they've hit an underground river called a fissure, and they've had to just stop till they can get the $100 million piece of equipment out from an underground flooded river. Like, that's a two-year job. So you can have as predictive and as accurate. This, it's not, I guess, like consumer modeling. It's very long term. There's a lot of inputs coming in from, let's say, the engineering side of things. And they speak a whole different language because they come at it from like high levels of optimization, like really granular detail. And it literally goes into the financial model as one line. So I need to map, try and understand what's gone in, what the expectations of those shareholders are, and build, you know, that predictive model where they can say, oh, look, in 2027, this project's looking really sketchy. So we go back to the geologists. Okay, look, is there any way we can smooth out that dip in cash flows in 2027? Like, okay, yeah, if we bring this forward, move that stockpile there, change the processing plant to take this much per year, not this much per year, and change all these things, then we'll get a shorter mine life, but it will be a lot smoother. So that's quite an interesting, you know, that is, it's modeling, but it involves quite a few different people and no one person drives the one. I guess I'm in the middle seeing the whole thing. Yeah.
So, and from your perspective, you've built these models from the ground up, from your experience, not necessarily using somebody else's, but you've done it personally, right?
Yeah. No. Yeah, that's right. So from a professional point of view, no one really worth their salt is going to take someone else's work and build on it. Now, that's business as usual in lots of other fields, and it is within the company. CFO says, look, I've made a start, send it to their senior analyst or vice versa. They add some stuff, send it to a banker, they add some stuff, send it back. The engineers put some stuff in. And then you have this kind of Frankenstein thing that no one's really got ownership of. Four people have done it four different ways, and it gives a number. And it goes to a bank, and the bank adds their, you know, own sophisticated analysis in. And at the end of the day, someone turns around and says, we just don't have the confidence that this thing is working. And, you know, there's a whole industry which I've been involved in for a long time, which is called model auditing, which is taking that piece of work and literally checking it, signing it off. And if we're wrong, you can sue us for $20 million. Like, it's big stakes. So it's not much fun checking someone else's kind of work. Imagine, you know, if you're in DevOps, you've got protocol, a lot, you've got protocols, you know, very standardized environments. And that's just not the case in finance, which, you know, the numbers are, we're not talking about, you know, rolling out a new product and spending a few tens of millions. We're talking about investing hundreds of millions of dollars on long-term assets, you know. So it's all done in Excel, which is, in a way, is kind of good because it's, you know, I could send what I'm working on this afternoon to you, and you will understand what it's doing. If you were to send me something in a script that I wasn't familiar with and I started looking at it, I would, you know, you'd be clutching at straws. So there is some sense in the way it's done, but yeah.
How do you find the approach in regards to, and I know a lot of your background's also in risk management, Nick. So how do you find the Australian approach to risk? You know, do you find people here are much more conservative in regards to the projects they undertake? Do they look at things differently when you're presenting your modeling back, say, compared to people in London or the States? Is there a different mentality or you know, more questions? Do you find any differences?
It's a really good question. And you've caught me on the fly. I would say that it's industry specific, not country specific. And I think the reason for that is, say you've got a global bank, Citibank, HSBC, you know, name a bank that's not, you know, global, and they're probably not in this game. And they will have head offices, centralized approaches to things. So no, I'd say it's sector specific. If you're in mining versus wind power versus toll road development, there's, you know, industry standards on the returns that should be getting and the approach to doing it. And these banks even align themselves in these sectors as well. So it's a good question. I think it's a good question because, you know, things are a bit different in Australia. We are, with all respect, we're very sheltered from the massive ups and downs in the world, with the exception of resource crashes and peaks, which also causes stress. You know, and we do have a slightly different approach just culturally to, say, a Chinese bank or a German bank. That's a great, you know, that's a great analogy. But I've worked with both over the years. I'm always working with a range of banks. So, like, the banking personality is always someone I see quite a lot of. And I can't see that it's, no, it's very much industry specific. So I'd say no.
That's really good to know. I mean, the other area as well is with the way things are now moving in regards to, you know, access to capital and having, you know, a lot more of the VC availability as well. Are you also working with some of these sort of newer gen organizations as well as some of the more traditional ones as well?
So a lot of my work's quite institutional. So because the funding required is massive, it generally requires, you know, say 3 or 4 of the likes of a CBA, an HSBC, a BNP. No one of them on their own is going to come close to financing the total requirements. So, and the returns are surprisingly low. So the returns are, you know, there's an upfront fee, maybe that's 1% of the amount that's lent. So, you know, say it's $500 million gig, that's kind of a work fee. And then the returns, well, if you think of the returns are essentially outside of any hedging, which is reasonably lucrative, and a lot of the reason the banks are there, if not to get physical offtake of, say, a gold project, to offset their other contracts, is, you know, essentially the interest. And even though interest rates are low, the margins are quite high. So as margins went down, as base rates went down, like LIBOR and BBS, YNW went down, the margins kind of compensated to fill the gap. But if you think about it, let's say it's a 5% return. That's, you know, that's superannuation level returns. And I think the firms you just mentioned, they're probably looking for the high single digits, kind of mid-teens returns, those VCs, if not more. So I think it's what you often find is that they'll be looking to get involved in a different way, like to provide some quite high-risk financing quite earlier on in the transaction, way before I'm involved. And maybe they'll take a royalty stream for that, which is, you know, very lucrative. So I think it's, whilst they might be there, they're probably there a lot earlier in a more prospective approach.
And what you're finding, as obviously you've been investment banking, you see the macroeconomics of situations, particularly the last 18 or 12 months with the pandemic. What's your opinion on the financial markets and the, you know, the economic conditions in general?
Yeah, interesting. I mean, we all see the same news, don't we? I think it's fair to say that COVID is almost like a bit of a placeholder for something that it wasn't an if, it was a when. And if you love or hate Bill Gates, he's probably got a very legitimate case for saying I told you so at the moment. Look, I think in terms of the market, the impact on the market that COVID's had, I think for listeners outside of Australia, you know, outside of hospitality and tourism, which, you know, have suffered a lot, we've been pretty well insulated compared to the UK or the US. So I'd like to properly answer that question, we should probably have a bit of a look at the situation globally with a different lens to what we see here as an Aussie experience. One of the things I think we've seen definitely, which one way or the other impacts the global markets, you know, indirectly or directly, is, you know, the exacerbation of the wealth inequality. So the gap between rich and the poor. I think it was quite clear during COVID, and this is something, you know, I think you probably only have to look around your own social group to realize that the bank manager, the lawyer, or the company director probably just worked from home for a few weeks. And their biggest complaint after they realized the job was safe was, I need a proper desk and chair at home. Whereas the air hostess, the cafe worker, and the taxi driver, you know, they had to find alternate sources of income and probably make some pretty tough decisions, much more in line with what we've seen on the news from the UK and US. So look, I'm not an advocate enforcing an equilibrium for the sake of it, but in this case, I think the long-term forecast certainly doesn't look any better due to COVID. Obviously, there are industries that are going to boom. Love to have been a home office manufacturer a year ago. But look, I think if we are to try and answer your question, there are three things, and I think they all impact. Devaluation is probably the biggest impact. So medium-term economic impact of funding of a support package, you know, has to come from somewhere. And whilst whilst we're okay in Australia, I think that in the UK and the US, just they're coming out of the hole, but surely there has to be some kind of booster program down the track. And when you think about how long it's going to take for the general population in taxes to repay the amount of funding that's had to be dug into, you know, it's a shocking number. It's like your grandchildren will be paying it off, much pretty similar to the World War II kind of impact. So I kind of equate it in my head as we've like had a major war globally, and this is, we have to recover economically from it. We know that takes kind of 10 years. Probably some longer term damage to the economy of businesses that are otherwise viable, having just been severely stressed. And I think air travel's, you know, the one that's really easy to identify. It's not being shut down, but it's been so stressed. When it recovers, what will it look like? And there's some really interesting papers on, will air travel be cheaper or more expensive? And there's some really good arguments for both. Bit too specific, but look, I think overall, there's that you have to take into account, I think, that the impact on, say, non-COVID related health and then on-flowing education impacts are going to be massive, probably not in Australia, but people just not going to hospital for that treatment, for that checkup, having an exam for listeners in Oz who aren't quite so sure what's going on in the UK, for example. Last year's main student exam, so think of the HSC, were cancelled and they were evaluated on indicative performance, like how you went in your mock exams and how your school as a whole has performed on previous years. I'd be in a horrible position to be in. So, look, there's all going to have economic impacts down the track. No one can put their finger on it. But I'd say it's all going to evolve at one point or another in government having to circulate more money. I think everything boils down to that.
And also, you mentioned the word devaluation, as you mentioned with that. Obviously, Australia is sitting on about, I think last time I looked, is on 50 to 54% of GDP to debt growth or debt ratio there, which is quite low compared to the US, about 120%. I looked at it last time of their debt ratio. Obviously, if there is money printing going on around the world, which is going on at a rate of knots, something I looked at it last year, something like $32 trillion or something like that, you know, global stimulus in Euro, US, you name it. But the big thing I noticed is that Australia, yes, we might have kept our debt low, but we do import a lot of goods into Australia. So if other countries are printing, do we see an inflationary impact to our imported goods? You know, do we pay the price elsewhere down the road as Australians?
Yeah. Look, I don't think I have, you know, a massively detailed answer for something like that. I would tend to agree with you. And you can cite things, you know, like the move away from, I think the only thing that's probably saved us from a really tough hit is that we've moved away from production. But I have to think inflation and CPI is a really broad brush to apply to a massive basket of goods, which isn't relevant to everyone. So there's, I think if you're evaluating, you know, monetary supply and inflation, you kind of have to think that we've got an increasingly sophisticated services economy. which has got a, you know, pretty low fixed cost. It's got a very low cost to deliver additional services. That economy responds very well to the changes that we've just experienced. So if you think about retail banking is a really good example. So let's say your job's a mortgage advisor, and COVID hit. Well, your office in your local branch, you can't go there anymore. You can't go and visit someone, and people aren't applying for mortgages. So within like 1 or 2 weeks, some of the large Australian banks had retrained some of their, let's say, mortgage advisors or brokers, you know, as a placeholder for that kind of role, into customer support for the web page, you know, or for web banking, internet banking, or something else. So that's something that if you were producing widgets in a factory, your best bet is producing hand sanitizing lotion. Like, there's really, you haven't got much room to maneuver. So I think, you know, I think we can respond to it fairly well, and I would agree with your comments, but I think, you know, it's such a broad question, hard to argue against. I think that would be a tough debate.
So I guess, what does the future hold for you, Nick? Like, you know, obviously working on, you know, continually on the modeling components, but is there anything you're working on, like, you know, in the innovation space in the sector? Obviously it is highly niche and you are one of the experts in this space, but is there anything you're working on to sort of future-proof what you're doing?
Right. So the answer to that is no. I think I'll just carry on doing what I'm doing until it no longer exists. I really enjoy it. I can't say it's a passion project. I wouldn't do it if I wasn't being paid. The market's pretty good. I have a good network. The work's interesting. And if it all dried up tomorrow, I'd have something else to do with my time. So I think some cracking ideas of things that I would do differently if we did it all again, having spent 10 years building a business in a particular sector, and working with other firms as well. Like, I work with people who used to be my competition fairly regularly. And I see them do things, I think, oh, that would be a perfect thing to build a web service for, not, you know, do it in Word or something. So the whole industry hasn't changed for a long time. But I also think, you know, the client base hasn't as well. So just to, you know, you go into I often would send something to a bank, and it could be an international bank that you know really well, and the logo's up in on the skyline of most cities. And you send them an Excel file, and they, oh, we can't open it. We've only got Excel XYZ, and it's like 6 years old, and it can't open a certain format. And you think, oh man, like if we're still dealing with the lowest common denominator, innovation is quite hard. It's not something the industry focuses that much on. Like, it, I think the higher risk the sector, and it's quite a risky job. So imagine pulling all this information together and it being wrong. So you kind of, if you're innovating, it has to improve your risk position, and also be able to be adopted. So for example, I give lots of training, and I do it in person to kind of groups of one or two people to 15 odd. And during COVID, we just switched to online. Like, that was pretty much a no-brainer. And the experience was okay. Like, you know, feedback goes from something like a 9.5 out of 10 average to 8 out of 10. And everyone notes that it's because of COVID. But then you go to share the link with, you know, you've got people from 10 different banks coming on, and your choice is Skype, Microsoft Teams, and Zoom. You can't get a common platform. So what do you do? So people are logging on with personal laptops and, you know, just stuff that's outside protocol. So look, long-winded answer to innovation. It's not a big feature of the industry I'm in. And also I'm kind of towards the tail end of working it, I think.
The case of if it ain't broken, don't fix it, I guess.
Look, I lost track of the number of times I've said to people, look, just get, you know, and this is awfully cliched nowadays in the world of memes, but get outside of your comfort zone. Like, I was saying that back in pre-millennium bug. Just do things that make you uncomfortable and you'll thrive. And I think as I get older, I'm telling people to stay in their comfort zone, do what you're really good at, because then, you know, it's just life's a lot easier. So, and you have more time to do other things. I think when you're always searching for the next big thing, there's a risk you don't find it. So, and you kind of lose what's sitting right in front of you. So,
well, anyway, I think it's
interesting question.
In certain areas, I think that is good advice. I think one of the issues we fall into in the tech sector is we change for the sake of change, but don't evaluate any sort of business use for the change. Everyone gets hyped up on it and it hasn't really proven anything to be beneficial. So if we already have a long history of, you know, existing model components that work, of strategy that works, and a presentation media such as Excel that, you know, is doing enough of a job to guarantee, you know, a risk analysis, then what is then the justification, I guess, to go ahead and change?
Well, look, as a great, like, you know, you segued into something I found quite interesting the other day, and I was reflecting in a training course to, I teach a lot of grads who, like, as part of graduate academies, coming into institutional banking for the first time, and just help set the whole modeling context. Like, you are going to have to grind that handle really hard, and there's going to be some times where it's not that much fun. But one of the things is, you know, when you do use, I say script, and I'll say with a lowercase s because it's Visual Basic, but that's not changed since, like, I watched it come out. I got the release on my old Toshiba laptop, and back in 90 something, and it out, and, you know, no one knew it was coming, because there was no Google and no newsfeed. And it's like, oh, okay, if you Alt F11, you'll get into Visual Basic, and this allows you to automate things. Okay, right. It looks exactly the same today. Exactly. Every single part of it is exactly the same as it was in 1990, someone will quote me, but 1998-ish when it came out. So imagine that. The IDE, you know, I just say that because that's my equivalent, hasn't changed since the late 90s. So if that doesn't change, you know, that's the nature of the, not that Excel is written by finance experts, but, you know, it's not a, your life cycle for change is probably weeks or months. Like, the next collaboration platform is available, we'll all move to it. It's like a new nightclub opening. But I've got friends in DevOps, I think we've got mutual friends, and kind of hear a fair bit about, we should try this, we've dropped that, we're doing this. We're like, okay, right, okay. Now I'm still in Excel and I'm still tracking my timesheet with the same app I've been doing for the last kind of 15 years. So, yeah, I'm gonna politely say innovation is not a massive part of the industry, but there are some areas it could do a lot better. But, yeah, I'm got past my time in trying to change it.
Oh, look, I still pull data into pivot tables.
Oh, okay. You're why I've got a job.
It's a quick fire solution to find something, you know, and then do it.
Yeah. Well. Yeah. Right. Well, look, if you, yeah, sometimes. I mean, look, yeah.
Definitely.
Good.
Okay. Yeah. Well, the same goes, look, we've having conversations recently where people, they're a standard database system with an application layer, right? So people are trying to pitch blockchain solutions for some very simple database solutions. And as you mentioned, innovation trying to be applied to something that's simple, that's not solving that business problem, right? So there's a lot of those kind of things we're seeing at the market. And I think you've nailed it on the head today with a lot of the stuff you're doing. You're doing things 20, 30 years ago that are very, you know, quite complicated, but are still done well with Visual Basic today.
Yeah, I mean, like the method of, and I think there's this preconception of finance being, you know, this complicated animal. Everything's basically one number divided by another one. So, you know, there's some, all the work required to get to the numerator and denominator is, sure, that's a significant amount of work, which you can do and be proud of. But at the end of the day, I think the worst piece of work I've ever seen goes back quite a few years. And I did a bit of digging as to who the author was. And they said, oh, no one can understand it. Is this Russian nuclear physicist who this bank got to come and do the work? And I'm looking at it, I'm like, whew, right. Like, my approach is to say we're adding three things together and multiplying by something else. Sorry to send you to sleep. But you bring each one in as a line, its own line, add them together. And on the fourth line, you bring in the thing you're multiplying by. And on the fifth line is the result. Like, it's not hard. It's not rocket science. But, you know, I think people have, you know, look, and that's unfair, I think, because smart people who want an intellectual challenge kind of sometimes see the challenge where maybe it's not there and they bring their set of skills. So just have to filter it out, I think. But the maths of finance is pretty straightforward as long as you keep it broken down. If you try and do everything in one go, like you could transform as a thought experiment, I could take, so for example, for me to build a piece of work, it will take me probably on average from start to finish a year. So imagine but the 90% of that work will be done within the first 4 weeks. So that's when someone who knows what they're up to is spending that much time in that environment. That's quite a lot of work can be done. It's quite a substantial file. and, you know, what's the best way of saying this? I think there's only so many ways you can lay this thing out, but the market standard is in quite an unreadable manner. It's like, you know, it's a bit of a mess. If I was to send you a piece of well laid out analysis, you'd go, yeah, I get it. If I send you what I normally receive from a client, you'd go, I just don't know. I can only understand this by putting it on one screen and working my way through. And then at the end of it, you'd go, yeah, 100% get it. That's not hard. We've made it hard by not laying it out properly. So the thought experiment, just going back to what I was saying a minute ago, is that what if you could take that whole framework and put it in one formula or one routine that runs and it goes, the number you're looking for is this. You wouldn't be able to trace it back at all. And it would be an intellectually, you know, challenging proposition, but of absolutely no use because, and I think this is where innovation doesn't have too much of a role, because the best result is the one that's laid out in the most, simple is the wrong word, but I think elegant and clear manner, which I don't think you find so much in data modeling, because that's an exercise in smarts and power.
Keep it simple, as you're saying. That's all right. Obviously you've been an investment banker and with the devaluation of money and so forth, and the use of gold obviously is a hedge for a lot of people trying to protect their wealth, right? What are your thoughts on using Bitcoin during this pandemic, doing that? Is that something you're into and does it make sense to you?
So I've mentioned mining a few times, but I don't think I've explicitly said I do a lot of work in mining. Most of my work's in precious metals and commodities. So based, you know, the economics of digging them up out the ground and selling them one way or the other. So when we know gold's a long-term, forever has been, you know, really, it has some utility, but it's predominantly a store of wealth slash jewelry. Probably about half of what's roughly half the market for gold is in storage of wealth one way or the other versus industry and electronics and that kind of thing and currency. So I've been a long-term believer that gold is a great place to put some money, but never really quantified it in my head, rationalized it until I had the time to really understand Bitcoin, which is, you know, it definitely its reputation has got a bit better recently. It's been around, 10 odd years. And I've encountered it a few times over those years in the form of mucking about doing some mining, you know, just some things. I just found it quite interesting. But I think I've started more recently, so let's say in the last year, 18 months, to really delve into it and understand the mining, the trading, and the infrastructure angles of Bitcoin. So, and the way I've explained it to people who have asked the same question, you know, I think Bitcoin is a bet against government. So it's a hedge for, if you think, just pause on that for a second and just think how government works. they're generally in term for a short period of time compared to the time over which you're saving and investing. They've got pretty blunt instruments in the form of monetary policy. So they can change interest rates. They can increase the amount of money in circulation. So M2 for anyone who's into economics. And they can, you know, indirectly or directly change the amount of either money that's, well, so M2, or they can manipulate the amount of government debt that's available or being bought back. So pretty blunt instruments, I think. And would I like to put my, say, so I thought about this over a period of time and I thought, well, do I really want my future in the hands of predominantly at risk of being manipulated by this system? Now, that system affords me, I've got a social contract with that system. So good citizen, do the right thing, pay my taxes. They build the roads. All of that, I'm no, old Breitbart kind of mad conservative. But I would like to be able to not have someone else manipulate what my future looks like when it comes to the financial side of things. So I could use gold to do this, but when you look at gold over a period of time, it's like anything that's very well understood. It's kind of, you've got not so much of a competitive edge. And I think when you look at Bitcoin, it does take a bit of time to understand what it is. So there's a barrier to entry to benefiting from it. And that's something I wanted to make sure that not all of my funds, but enough such that if the first section didn't do as well as I was planning, my hedge more than compensated for it. So not really in it for big overnight gains. And I think, you know, anyone that's in it has had woken up to some great pieces of news over the last few months, and over the last week or so, some less good pieces of news. But, you know, there's kind of noise. I think my view is Bitcoin's a long-term hedge on government decisions that might not be, you know, they're kind of trapped into the system. So it's not like they're bad, but if you were in government, you wouldn't be able to do much else than use these levers either. But I think it's a good way of not being completely dependent on it. But that's Bitcoin. And then you've got the altcoins, which happy to chat about as well. So I think they're completely different.
How do you see the altcoins in your strategy if you use them that way? I know I use them to pull profit off and actually buy more Bitcoin, but
yeah,
similar kind of process.
Yeah, pretty much. That's a good, really good way of describing it. So probably two-pronged approach to altcoins. So for anyone that's on the podcast who's, you know, not into crypto, you've got Bitcoins, which is like essentially gold. It's the biggest market cap and very high liquidity. And then you've got everything else, of which there's many, many kind of options. In the same way that I think Bitcoin's a hedge against government performance, then altcoins are a bet on, let's say, decentralized finance, which for some people's kind of a bit of a new term. But, you know, essentially deregulating the way money flows and how it's governed in certain situations and on, you know, certain networks. And no reason somebody has to take euros or US dollars or Aussie dollars to perform something for you, a piece of work. So lots of different systems setting up smart contracts and, you know, from gaming all the way through to, you know, all the way through to Ethereum, which is really well established and on a good journey. So I see a little bit of the fun is in the alts, in the sense of you read about something, you hear about something, you do some research. This is like betting on or investing in a junior miner who you hear has got a good tenement, got some good exploration results and a good management team and have just done well somewhere else. But I think with alts, there's always something a bit more fundamental. Like this morning I was listening about Ravencoin. and, you know, the way that works. It's like, yeah, okay, I would have never heard of anything like that before. That's innovative. It sounds like a good idea. Not sure if it is in the long term, but hey, here's a little position to see how it goes over the next, say, couple of months. And when it does get to the point where I'm either happy just to get out because I've not lost too much or it's done well, I generally convert that into Bitcoin as the kind of the gold standard. So, you know, that bet against government is the, I think that's where the long-term growth is. You don't really hear people on market commentators talking about what, you know, Wink might do by 2035. You just don't hear it, do you? So, but in terms of where Bitcoin might be, by the time you're ready to pull the pin and spend some money, yeah, is, you know, that's a number that people talk about. So, yeah, so two different things, obviously, but both are interesting. Look, to me, it kind of feels like a smart way. It's a smart way to save for the future and stuff that it's something you don't know what's coming and when you'll need it. But it's a pretty liquid asset, and it's something no one else is going to do for you. So, but it does take, has got an intellectual barrier. There is a certain amount of understanding you need to have gathered before you put enough money on the line to make it worthwhile. That's non-trivial, I found.
Excellent. That's all right, Michael. Please continue.
Oh, that's good to see you taking it seriously in your portfolio. It's interesting to see, you know, some of your experience and fantastic.
Yeah, well, look, I think if you compare it to gold, gold today, all of my current clients are kind of panicking at the moment, but gold unfortunately has dropped quite a lot in the last few weeks. It's kind of in Aussie terms, you know, just a touch over $2,000, $2,200, something like that. It was 500 odd 2001, 2002, US dollars. So look, that's an increase, $1,700 over a 20-year period. So if you invest, you know, that's an annual return of 4.5%. So unless you're playing the daily swings and you're getting in one month, getting out the other, or you've got a genuine reason to hold gold, like you just like the look of it, or you like having it physically in the safe, which you can do with Bitcoin, of course. It doesn't sound like, when you look back on it, a great asset, but because it's gold, it's kind of got it's pretty well branded. It's got a good marketing team, but it's not great returns. And it is reasonably volatile. You just need to, you know, look at what the plot looks like over the last 20 years. And you look at it over the last year, yeah, it looks good. Look at it over the last 20 years as a long-term hold, just how I look at Bitcoin. And I think it's, maybe it's not such an interesting place to put your money for an increased level of risk compared to a 5% bond, you know, 20-year government bond. Boring, but, you know, it's better.
We'll have to get you to do some risk analysis on that one for us as well, Nick, I think. But look, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on today. And you know what, this is a very... For me and Michael, especially since coming from a background where we've had to do so much data and analytics, this is a really, really interesting sector for us, even though it's very niche. So we wanted to thank you for coming on board and sort of give us a bit of an insight, you know, on how some of these larger projects, you know, go and approach for capital raising and what are some of the factors that need to take into account. And I know we've just scratched the surface. So I think it'd be wonderful to get you back another time to just dive a bit deeper into that, because I think there's some very interesting talking points that you raised earlier.
I'd be happy to do that. And I think something that will also be worth touching on is quantum computing, which is like my little, not a side project, but something I keep a very close eye on and I think is going to have some pretty major impacts, not over the next year, but over the next 10 years. So, yeah, happy to have a chat. Always happy to chat.
Fantastic. Well, thanks, Nick. I really appreciate that. Quantum computing that's something we'll definitely have a dedicated conversation about.
I'd love to. Yeah. We can talk. And my mum probably thinks I did horoscopes for 5 years, but I basically did quantum mechanics and general relativity. So it's something that, you know, I'm a keen watcher. So can I have a good chat about that when you feel like it? All good.
All good. Looking forward to it. Well, thank
you. All right. Thanks, guys. Nice to chat as always.
Bye-bye.
See ya.